Thank you so much. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just so pleased to be here. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me back. I was here 13 years ago, which usually means that whoever's responsible has less than 13 years of sobriety. But I really am delighted and honored to be asked back. And I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank Bill and his wife Barbara for taking such good care of us. And I'd like to thank Barbara A. for that beautiful basket. Gee, I can eat through that thing for a week. And I want to thank the rest of the committee for having us. And I especially want to thank the committee for inviting our spouses. I'm gone a lot of weekends, and I miss my lovely wife, Julia, very, very much. It's always a great privilege to be able to travel with her. And I'd like you to meet her, my wife, Julia. I want to congratulate Bill for all the years of love and service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Things have changed in AA. You know, in the old days, your name had to be Bill or Bob in order to get sober. Fortunately, that's changed, letting the rest of us in. I was always struck by the old-timers. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 29 years ago, and by the grace of God, I haven't had a drink since. But I was always attracted to the old-timers. I don't know whether I was just a sucker for punishment or what it was, but it was just something about the old-timers that I just loved. It was a serenity and a sense of humor and all of that. And I'm so profoundly grateful for the interest that they took in me. And I said to one of them one time, you know, you make me feel like I'm the most important person in the world. And he said, this very moment you are. And it tells me everything I need to know about the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just really love them. I've been rough on them over the years. And I'd like to thank and welcome our newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember traveling to a meeting one day with my sponsor, and I was pretty new in the program, and I was a little upset. I was always upset, but I was deeply sensitive and high-strung. And I said to my sponsor, I said, when am I going to stop being a newcomer? And he said, whenever you stop getting angry every time they say newcomer. You know, the following week, we're going to the same meeting. And I said to him, I said, you know, I hope Bill will be there. And he said, who's Bill? I said, that was the new guy who came last week. It was his first meeting. And I said, you know, every day this week, I pray that God keep me sober and he keep you sober and he keep Bill sober. And my sponsor, Dan, looked at me and smiled and he said, you're no longer a newcomer. So if you can have a weak moment and think of someone else, just for a moment, you're over a hump. I used to tell people to stay away from old-timers, that they weren't nice people. And it's true. It's true. I look down at my friend Don, who I've known for a long time, and he's an old-timer. They're all the same, you know. They love it when we have problems. The only enjoyment they get out of life is laughing at our problems. If you don't believe me, go to one of them after the meeting and tell them a problem. The first thing they'll do is laugh. You know. And if you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex. You know? And the answer is always the same, no sex. They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. That's what they're saying. I was born in a small town in Ohio, birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. That will come as a surprise to some of our friends from the West Coast, but it really did. really did start in Ohio, and just south of where I was born, as a matter of fact. I was the second child, and the eldest son in a family of 11 children. I was Irish. I won't tell you what church I went to. has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say anymore. I was irritable and discontented from the very beginning, and I would have told you that I grew up in poverty, which would have not been any more true than anything else I would have told you. But the reality was that we had no excess material goods, that's for sure, and frequently ran out of food before we ran out of mouths. But we were anything but poor, because I had a mother who every day I let her would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And I had a father who every day I let him would spend time with me. And I look back now at those days and recognize just how fabulously wealthy I really was. I had it all. I was a little kid with a speech impediment. Nobody could understand anything that I said, except the people who loved me. They all treated me like I was normal. It was a lot like when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They couldn't understand anything I said either. They treated me like I was normal. But it was a wonderful place to grow up. And yet, even with all of that, I was different. I didn't belong there. And I don't know what that's about. I really don't know what that's about. But I know that it was true. I know that I had all these things that I knew that I couldn't talk about. For example, something lived under my bed. And at night, I could press my little ear against the mattress, and I could hear it moving around down there. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. And I was history, and I knew that. And I couldn't talk about it. And I knew one day they'd all be having breakfast, and they'd say, "Where's Keith?" They'd say, "Oh, no, the thing under the bed got him." And it would be over. And I knew I couldn't talk about those things. I went off to school, and the little nun in the first grade, all the parents were there, and the little nun in the first grade said, "Is there anybody who knows a song that can sing for us?" And my mother told me I was a good singer, so I put up my hand, and all the parents were in the front of the room, and my mother just sort of began to drift to the back of the crowd, and I stood up and sang that old favorite, "I'm a gand old fag, I'm a high fine fag," My mother was so proud she had tears in her eyes. I was a kid who tried very, very hard to be good. I really tried to be good. I just tried as hard as I could to be good, but I was never quite good enough. So about the time I got to the sixth, seventh grade, something like that, I decided it's going to be bad. And so I started being bad. And I wasn't even good at that, but I was better at being bad than I was at being good. I got into a lot of trouble. I was suspended 20 times or something in high school. I went to a Central Catholic high school. And once our pastor, all the pastors of different parishes sat on the school board. And he called me one time. Monsignor Close called me, and he said, "Keith?" I said, "Yes, Father." He said, "Is this a little potato?" He always called me a little potato. I said, "Yes, Father." And he said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, I was worried." He said, "I was at the school board meeting, and your name never came up. I thought maybe you were sick." It was really something. If we'd have had any money at all, I'm convinced I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. And one of the things I had to do in high school was, if you got into trouble, you had to serve detention. And this was a central high school, and this was many miles from my home, so I'd have to hitchhike home all the time, and always had a job, so I'd hitchhike to my job. And one of the things you had to do, too, was you had to spend time in the library with Sister Victoria. Now, you got to picture Sister Victoria, okay? She was this little nun who would run up and down the hall and say weird things like, "Every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father's a king. Isn't that weird? And so we call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary. And and you had to serve detention with Sister Victoria in a library, and you couldn't just sit there. You had to do something because, you know, if you're not busy, you're in trouble. And so we had to make rosary beads. Okay, those are the things that Catholics pray on. And they gave us pliers and wire and little beads and crucifixes and medals, and you make these rosary beads. And I got good at it. I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria. She used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. And so I'd sit back there making these rosary beads, and my rosary beads were different. All the others had 10 beads on each decade. Mine had 11. And so after 4 years, I had hundreds and hundreds of mutant rosary beads. And they sent them all over the world to the missions and things. And you know, this nun never caught on. And so, much to everyone's surprise, I graduated. And I had to tell her, you know, if they don't know, you wasted all that time. So I went to see Sister Victoria, and I said, Sister, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? She said, yes, you sly little prince. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the decades of the rosary, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest idea why I do this thing. And she said, people all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that, too? And so I graduated from high school, and I had no earthly idea of what I was going to do. So I took an inventory, and it's probably the first inventory I ever took in my life. I didn't get a pencil. What I did was I took my shirt off, and I stood in front of the mirror, and I flexed my muscles and turned sideways and stuck my chest out. And I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer, so I... I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And I failed to share that with my parents. And I wasn't yet 18, so they had to sign for me to go. So the recruiter showed up, and it nearly killed my mother, poor thing. And she was crying and everything. And my dad said, son, are you sure you want to do this? I said, Dad, I've thought this over a long time. Like 2 hours, I thought it over. And I said, this is what I've always wanted. For 2 hours, and he said, well, all right, so they signed, and I'll never forget, my mother cried all night, and she kept saying, I could hear him in the next room, she kept saying, Scott, they'll kill him, and my dad kept saying, don't worry, Pat, they won't take him, and so, with that vote of confidence, the next morning, we took a taxi cab over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a Greyhound bus, and I went to Pittsburgh to be sworn in, to get my physical and to be sworn in. It was 60 miles from my home, and it's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. And, you know, I was a kid who knew nothing about anything, and I'd never gone anywhere, never done anything. And all of a sudden, you know, it was a bad year. They took you if you had a pulse. And so that afternoon, I was sworn in the United States Marine Corps. And the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps was that they took a certain number of young men to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I know. And yet I knew I couldn't ask. You know, the way I lived my life was I never knew what was going on. I thought everybody in the world had a big picture, and I was the only one who somehow was left out of the instructions. And so what I did was I watched what you did. And I did it so quickly after you did it, it looked like we were doing it together. I was that fast. And so there were four of us that fateful day, and so we were sworn in about 4 o'clock, and our train was leaving to take us to South Carolina at midnight. So the guys said to me, hey, kid, we're going to go over and have a couple of beers and a sandwich. I said, that's just what I was thinking. So we went over, and I'll never forget that day. It's a critical day in my life because that's the day that my life changed. And that's the day I changed. And for the first time in my life, I fixed what was wrong with me. You know, I'd been on some championship baseball teams, and I was in a lot of trouble, but I was a merit scholar and things like that. I just had 23 Fs and a D in conduct for 4 years of high school, and I got a D the last marking period because the principal said nobody's getting out of here with a big score. So so I was a punk, but I wasn't stupid. And I'd gotten, you know, my share of pats on the back and that sort of thing. But they never lasted, see. They never really meant anything. And on the way home, I knew they had made a mistake and given a trophy to the wrong guy. And yet that day in Pittsburgh, we walked into that bar, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. The place was filled with real men, you know, the kind. And all of them had real women with them. You know, real women, or women who hang around with real men. And guys like me used to get what was left. And we went over and sat down, and the bartender came over. He's a real man. He said, "What do you want?" And my first thought was, "Oh, my God, a quiz." That's just the way I thought about life. I thought that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper. Put your name in the left-hand corner." And they'd ask you a bunch of questions. And I studied all the time, but I never studied the right stuff. And it's just the way I felt about life. I was always on the outside. And I didn't know how to answer that question, so I watched these guys. And they ordered a beer, so I did too. And the guy came back and asked the same question. They gave him the same answer. He came back the third time. I ordered first. I'd become a leader. Between the second and third beer, my life changed. And it changed in a way that was to dictate the rest of my life. It was amazing. You know, somewhere around the third drink, I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up. I couldn't keep from standing up. And the floor was like 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out to here. My left shoulder, and the muscles were rippling through my body. And, you know, that mind had been filled with fear and terror. It was like, boom, it was crystal clear. And all of a sudden, I saw the big picture. And I remember thinking, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? And then I looked around, and my heart broke. That place was filled with a bunch of snivelling, pathetic little men. And they all had women with them, or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And it was magnificent. And I was infused with all this knowledge. And I never forget, I just went from table to table filling people in. It was just incredible. And I guess it's about 11 o'clock, and the guy said, "We better go." And I said, "Well, all right." And it seemed to me, this may not be entirely accurate, but it seemed to me that the people in that place were saying, "Please don't go." And I said, "Well, I have to go and make the world safe for democracy." And we went down and we got on the train. Now, that was an assumption. I assume we got on the train because I woke up on the train. And I think that's reasonable. I'll never forget waking up that morning on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps was kind enough to provide me with. And I found out later that isn't where you normally sleep in a Pullman coach. But someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever had done it wet me too. I changed clothes. I mean, I have some pride. And I got off the train, and the guy said, "What are you going to do, kid?" I said, "I'm going to go find a beer." And I did. I found a beer. And I drank from Washington, D.C. to Yamasee, South Carolina. If you've never been to Yamasee, I wouldn't bother. But it was late at night when we pulled in, and I fell. I don't know what happened. Somebody moved the bottom step or something, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks, and there was a very rude man there they had sent to greet us. And he was screaming at Senates and myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off, and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd get along a lot better if he treated us with a little respect. He never seemed to grasp what it was I was trying to relate to him, but a very limited man. I think it's because he was screaming so much. And, you know, it's hard to learn when you're screaming. Tell that to your sponsor. What I say, you can learn something from everything. And what I learned from that was you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from him. And I'll tell you something else. You can do push-ups and throw up at the same time, in case you're interested. But that was my second drinking occasion. My first drinking occasion happened, and I ought to talk about that, I guess. It happened when I was 5 years old. I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. And I was with my father and my brother, Dominique. Denny's a year younger than me, and still is. I don't know how we managed to do that, but he still is. And Mom was away. She was either having a baby or at the bingo or something. And Dad was watching us, and I think he just thought it'd be kind of cute. And he gave us each a beer. And I'll never forget, nothing happened to me. I drank my beer, nothing happened to me. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He was rolling around under the table singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And Dad panicked and put him in his jammies and took him up and put him in his little bed. And Den wasn't hearing it, though. He was jumping around and screaming and laughing and having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. My brother Denny stood up in his little bed and he urinated on the floor. You know? And I remember thinking, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. Danny's a big disappointment. He just never made it. I'll give you some examples, okay? Danny went to one college. It gets worse. He had one major. Yeah? And he graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing, graduating in 4 years. And he went to one graduate school, and he graduated first in his class and came out with an MBA. And he was offered like 8 jobs. He took one. Yeah? He retired about 5 years ago. He was a vice president of a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. And, I had to work at this thing. And the day after my push-ups, we got on a bus, and they took us into a place called Paris Island. And I was welcomed into the Marine Corps. And I must tell you, I loved everything about it. I loved it from the first day on. There were fewer people in the barracks than in my house, so... And the drill instructor seemed to be a little kinder than some of the nuns I had. So it wasn't a problem for me. And I threw myself into it. And I graduated from Paris Island with Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award. And I made up my mind that I was going to stay in the Marine Corps as long as I lived. I just loved it that much. And every promotion I got was a meritorious promotion. And I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps one time. And I made up my mind I was going to be the youngest commissioned officer. And I worked hard, and I got an appointment to go to officer's candidate school. And I ended up leading a patrol in a combat zone in a blackout. I don't remember going out, and I don't remember coming back. But I know the next day they woke me up, and I was in my tent, and I was fully clothed, and I had a .45 in my holster, and the hammer was back, and it was around the chamber, and there were 3 rounds missing. And I almost never slept like that. And I was supposed to go report to the company commander and tell him what had happened the night before. Problem was, I didn't know what had happened the night before. And so I got the guys to fill me in before I went over there. And I knew that the Marine Corps was an abnormal place, and it made me drink funny. So I threw that dream away, and I turned down a commission, and I got out. And I was to drink for 8 more years. I won't drag you through all of that. Suffice it to say that I discovered, for me anyway, that what alcoholism is just a spiritual illness. It never dampened my enthusiasm for life. But what happened was I would become very enthusiastic about life, and I'd fall in love with the way of life, like I did the Marine Corps. And then gradually, or not so gradually, I'd violate every principle associated with that way of life, and then I'd have to run away, and I would have to blame them for what happened to me. And that's the story of my alcoholism. I ended up married, and I did everything that you could do to violate the sacred oath of marriage. We had our first daughter, beautiful little thing, named Kelly, and I loved Kelly. God, I just loved her. I formed a relationship with her immediately and just loved her. And I always want to remember one day, she was 4 months old, and I came home, and my wife was an emergency room nurse, and they had a big accident. And so they called her in, and she said the baby formulas in the refrigerator, but she's sick. She said, don't wake up, let her sleep, and she's not feeling well. She's got a fever and everything. And she said, you know, your dinner's in the oven. And she kissed me on the cheek and took off and went to work, and or back to work. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? And I thought, my God, I don't have anything to drink. And I began to pace the floor, and I went next door, and he wasn't home. And so I paced the floor a little bit more, and I went in, and I looked at Kelly, and she was asleep in the crib. And I did what alcoholics do. I grabbed my keys and my money, and I took one more look at her, and I took off. And I ran out, and I got in the car, and I drove to the liquor store, and I grabbed my bottle, and I threw the money on a counter, didn't even wait for my change, and I drove back. My heart was pounding, and I was looking to see if the place was on fire, if there was, you know, and I was thinking about, you know, SIDS and all that stuff. And I ran in clutching my bottle to my heart to look at her, and she was okay. And then the self-recrimination started. You call yourself a father. You call yourself a man. And I would start beating myself up, and I would pour myself a drink in utter disgust. Talk to myself. You know, halfway through that bottle, I figured out what the problem was. You know, the problem was her mother, who should have been home, was over there trying to be a hero. That's what the problem was. And so this woman, who not only had to work 16 hours in an emergency room, and essentially in a bloodbath, come home from work, she had to listen to this drunken idiot rave on about her not fulfilling her duties and her obligations as a wife and a mother. That's the way I lived. That's what my alcoholism did. You know, my second daughter was born, and I was passed out on the floor. Bill mentioned last night about watching a test pattern. It was one of my favorite things. You young alcoholics missed a lot. cable TV, you don't have good test pattern watchers anymore. And if you ever decide to do it, it should be done in your underwear. Lying on the floor, you tend to get hurt less. And our second child came along, and she was over 2 months premature, and she weighed less than 2 pounds. And I took her mother to the hospital after her and the neighbors finally woke me up, throwing water on me and everything else, and finally got me up, and I rushed her to the hospital that I worked in, and in my drunken stage was demanding they take care of her, which was a joke. I was her husband, and I never took care of her. And the little girl was born, and they gave her absolutely no chance to live. And that's when I really, I think, got to know who and what I was. We had an office across from the neonatal nursery, and the chief resident happened to be a girl I'd gone to high school with, and back in Ohio, and this was in Washington, D.C., and she came to me and said, Keith, we have an experimental machine, and we would like to put your little girl on the machine. She said, I don't think she's going to live either way, I'll be honest with you. And if she lives, she'll be retarded. And I said, well, do whatever you think you need to do. And so they put her on this machine, and the first 3 days are very, very critical. And I spent my nights, it was 3 days I didn't drink, which was a real rarity for me. Rarely did I not drink every day. And I sat in the office with the door slightly ajar in the dark, and I watched this little thing struggle for every breath. And she was so tiny that she would actually retract when she'd almost lift her little body off the mattress when she tried to breathe. And I watched the woman I was married to walk up and down the hall with a 1,000-yard stare, basically in a state of shock. And I knew what to do, because I'd watched my father. My father was the greatest husband and father I ever knew. And I know what he'd have done. He'd have gone in and he'd put his arm around his wife and he'd have said, Pat, we have each other and we have God. We can do anything. We can face anything. We can accept anything. I just know that's what he'd have done. So I knew what to do. It wasn't not knowing what to do. The problem was there was nothing inside of me anymore. The thing, that essential being that God created was dead. I was dead. And what I did instead was I cowered in that room. And I watched my wife go in and baptize our little girl because they didn't think she lived through the night. And I remembered that I worked in a Catholic hospital. And I remembered I used to be a Catholic. And I ran down to the chapel in that hospital. And I got on my knees that night and I wept. And I asked God to please save my little girl. And I said, if you let her live, I'll do anything. If you let her live, I won't drink anymore. And I was drunk in 12 hours. I was drunk when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. and I just hated myself all the more. You know, my favorite philosopher is a French philosopher named Blaise Pascal. And Blaise said that God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor. And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. And that's not the way God does things. And she not only didn't die, she went on to be an honor graduate from Auburn University. I always tell her that I think you could graduate with honors from Auburn and be retarded, but she won't listen to me. So living a life like that, it can't last long. And one day my wife said to me what I had been hoping she would say in a certain way, and that is that we can't keep doing this. Because I knew I couldn't keep doing it. I was a madman. I was still going to work, or mostly going to work. And every morning, I was one of those drunks, where every morning on the way in to work, I'd pound on the steering wheel, and I'd swear I wasn't going to drink. And every day at 4 o'clock, I'd be sitting in Clyde's or Chadwick's or someplace, somewhere between a second and third drink, wondering what I'd been so excited about that morning. And it went in day after day after day. And I became crazy and abusive and just all kinds of things. So the day finally came when I had to leave, and I'm so grateful for that, because I went to where I had to go, and where I had to go was Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I was 29 years of age, and one day I walked into what passed for a bathroom in this place I lived, and I had a medicine cabinet full of drugs. You worked in a hospital, you could take about anything you wanted, and I had a medicine cabinet full of stuff that I never took. I know some of you think it's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just was afraid of pills and drugs. I thought if God made anything better than booze, he kept it for himself. That's how I thought. But it was there, and I went in one day to die. I had always thought that suicide would be a big deal. But, you know, for an alcoholic, it's just the next deal. The way I look at it was like whatever it took for the next drink was what it took. I remember one day I walked in the NCO club and I said, give me a double scotch on the rocks. And the bartender said to me, Corporal, that'll be 60 cents in your Marine Corps career. And I thought, that's about right. And I paid it. And then one day, I went into a liquor store and bought a bottle of gin or something, and they told me it was $6.75 in my family. I thought, that's about right. Anything to get back to Pittsburgh, to get back to that feeling, that sense of belonging and being somebody and being complete for the first time in my life. And then one day, I guess I went and bought some wine or something, and the guy at the liquor store says, that'll be 69 cents in your life. And I thought, it's about right. That's about right. So I think for this alcoholic, suicide isn't a big deal. One day it's just the next deal. And I went into that bathroom and I had every intention of never coming out alive. And I made a statement. I've gathered all the pills. And to this day, I don't know if I began taking them or not. I really don't. What I do know is I said aloud, I said, you know, you're 29 years old and at least this will be over. And a woman spoke to me. And she said, it's not over, it's starting. And it startled me. And I remembered that my ex-wife had given me a couple phone numbers when I left, and one of them was to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other one was to someplace else. And I went out and I pulled a drawer out, and everything fell on the floor, and I was crawling around on my hands and knees and looking for a phone number, and I found one, and I called it, and it happened to be a little treatment center. You know, a lot of speakers don't like treatment centers. I'll never say anything bad about treatment centers, because when I called, it was there. And there was a woman there who was an alcoholic who knew how to talk to me. And she also had a British accent, and for some reason that was reassuring. Now, I don't know why we ran those people out of here, but it was very reassuring. And she talked to me, and she could hear it in my voice. I know she could, and she asked me for my number and said she'd call me back. And I now know why, because, you know, if anything happened, she wanted to be able to call the police so they could trace me. And they told me that they could take me in this place in 3 days. And I turned around, I hung up the phone, and I looked, and it was almost a full bottle of scotch on a draining board. And I was given a great gift, and I was given the knowledge that if I took one drink, of that alcohol, I would die, and knowing I would die would never keep me from drinking. And you know, the fear of death was gone. And I ran over and I began to pour it out, and I knew I wouldn't. And I stood back and I threw the bottle as hard as I could, and it hit the sink and it broke. And if that bottle bounced, you'd have a different speaker tonight. Because I knew if I took one drink, I'd die, and knowing I'd die would never keep me from drinking. And you know what's true today? If I take one drink, I'll die. And knowing I'll die will never keep me from drinking. The only thing that will keep me from drinking is my active membership with you folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all the knowledge of the steps or anything else, none of that matters. What matters is my active participation in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I had to go get some money to go to this place, and I was in auditory hallucinations. I was hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. For the first few hours, it was very nice. Remember, I put a nickel in a parking meter, and out it came, and I stood there and listened to it for a while, and somehow I borrowed a couple $100, and I got in a car. It was 3 days later, and I had to drive to this place. It was 30 miles away, and it took me 5 or 6 hours to drive there, and I could only go about a mile, and I'd be terrorized, and I got out of the car, and I ran back and forth, and I wet my pants. I was sick, and I was throwing up, and I wet my pants, and I'm changing my pants beside my old 1969 Opel station wagon on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out. And I wondered what had gone wrong. And I got there, and it was late. Two things happened to me that day. The first thing that happened was a lady told me, she said, you know, Keith, you haven't been bad. You've just been real sick. And now, later when I got a sponsor, he told me that was wrong. I had been sick and bad. And the other thing that happened was they put me on a bus and they took me to a place I didn't know existed, and that place is, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I got off this bus and I walked up, and there was an old man standing at the door. When I got here, everybody was old, and he had like two heads. Wherever I looked, his face was there, you know, he was one of these guys looking in the eye, you know, the real obnoxious type. I was a shoe guy. I looked at shoes, but he was an eye guy. And he looked me in the eye, and he shook my hand, and he shook it very, very firmly. And he said, you know, son, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. And I just wanted to scream at him, mister, you don't know me. I'm a man who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. But, you know, he did know me. He knew me better than I knew me. And more importantly, he knew what I had, and he knew what I needed to do. And he took me inside, and he introduced me to a woman, this old lady. She got me a half a cup of coffee and sat next to me and patted me through the whole meeting. You know, my skin's crawling around on my body, and this old woman's patting me. Halfway through the meeting, she looked at me, and that old face exploded into a smile, and she said, honey, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And I began to cry. And I didn't know I was going to cry. And I didn't know that what I had been was lonely and alone. And I'd been alone my whole life. The only time I ever fit in. I mean, I was alone, surrounded by people who loved me. I'm convinced that alcoholism is that disease that doesn't permit me to experience the love that surrounds me. It's no wonder it's a spiritual illness. Because it doesn't even permit us to. It not only does it not permit me to experience the love God has for me, it forces me to deny it exists or to run from it. And I began this journey that night. It's an amazing journey. It's been incredible. And it's been wild, and it's been crazy, and it's been all kinds of things. And for you folks who are just looking at this program, I hope, I pray to God, you stay and you give this thing a chance. And, you know, I think it's fine to leave Alcoholics Anonymous after you have an appreciable amount of sobriety and you've worked the 12 steps to the best of your ability and you have a sponsor. And if you decide it's not for you, then that's one thing. But to make the decision before we know what's available here, I think is the biggest mistake we can make. And I remember I was out in Utah, and a fellow picked me up. He's a great guy. He picked me up at the airport. He was driving me to the conference. He's driving along. He said, And he said, I heard your tape. He said, you almost committed suicide, huh? And I said, yes. And he said, I almost did too. And he said, first thing my sponsor told me when I came to A was, he said, you're not permitted to commit suicide. And I said, why? He said, because you'd be killing the wrong man. And and that's true. And I began on this journey, and I just fell in with people. I just fell in with people who loved the activity and the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober 5 weeks, and I walked into a meeting, and it was a man came over. And I believe this is the day I joined AA. I really do. I walked in, and a guy came over, and he introduced himself. He said, I don't believe you've been at our meeting before. I said, well, I'm pretty new. And he said, well, that's nice. He asked me my name, and he asked me, do I have a family? And I said, yeah, I have two little girls, but she won't let me see them. And he said, you know, I've never seen a man stay sober and not see his children. And he said, what are their names? And I told him. And then he said, do you have a job? I said, well, I think I have a job at the university. They're thinking about it. And we talked a little bit more, and then he introduced me to some of his friends. And I remember those friends' names today. And they're all sober today. And the next week, I walked into the same meeting, and that man, whose name I couldn't remember, came over and said, Keith, how was your week? You remember my name. And he said to me, how are things at the university? I said, I have my job. He said, that's wonderful. He said, have you had an opportunity to see or talk to Kelly and Kimberly? He remembered the names of my children. And that's the day that I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the day I knew you were different than them. You really did care. It really did matter to you what happened to me. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow night? I said, nothing. He said, why don't you come with us? He said, we're going to the Howard Pavilion for the criminally insane. We take a St. Elizabeth's Hospital. He said, we take a meeting in there. And I said to him, I said, well, I won't know what to say, so you don't have to say anything. He said, just bring cigarettes. They always like the guy who brings cigarettes. So, I took cigarettes, and they really liked me. And the following week, I went to Lorton Reformatory, the first time I went into a prison as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have never been far from a prison from that day till this. This past May, by the grace of God, I celebrated 29 years of continuous sobriety in this program. I'm getting dangerously close to becoming an old-timer, and I'm really on the horns of a dilemma. If I drink, I'll die, but if I don't, I'll be an old-timer. And tough decisions. But you know, if you're kind of new and you feel like you're going crazy, it's normal. It really is. And I'm not being smart. I really mean that. I mean, I was a guy, for example, who couldn't sleep. And so I'd get up in the middle of the night, and I'd drive all around Washington, D.C., and I'd go visit all the monuments, and I'd read all this stuff, you know. And like at Jefferson Memorial is my favorite place, and I'd go down there, and I'd read that stuff. I'd say, that's beautiful. And I couldn't remember it the next day, so every day it was new. And I'd drive around till the sun came up, and I'd go home, I'd sleep for about an hour, and I'd go to work. And then one night, I went down to Jefferson Memorial, and I was just laying down looking at the stars, and I fell sound asleep. And I was so excited. I got up, I went home, I got a sleeping bag, I came back down, I laid it out. And I'm laying down and ready to go to sleep, and I heard, what are you doing here? And I looked, and it was the park police. And I said, well, I'll tell you. And I told them my story. And I said, I don't understand, but this is the only place I can sleep. And they said, really? I said, yeah. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, buddy, you need to sleep. You come on down here. So every few nights, you know, when I couldn't sleep for a few days or something like that, I go to the Jefferson Memorial with my sleeping bag, and I'd roll it out, and I'd be laying there, and I hear, hey, Keith, is that you? I said, yeah. And how many days? 50 days. That's great. You want some coffee? No, I better get some rest. I have to go to work. And that's the way it worked for me, and it's worked that way for me. It's been magic for me. And you know, I had a sponsor, a wonderful guy named Dan, and Dan and I were in 12-step calls 3 days a week, and oh, it's just wonderful. And we answered the phones at Intergroup for a year and a half together, and then And he said to me, Alan's coming along nicely. It was a guy I was sponsoring. I said, yeah, Alan's doing really well. And he said, look, you and Alan take over the phones. And so Alan and I answered the phones for a year and a half. And then Alan and the guy he sponsored answered the phones for a year and a half. And we always complain that a lot of the newer people in AA don't do things anymore. And I think it's maybe because we old-timers don't teach them how to do things. And I was taught how to do things. And nobody ever laughed at me. It was an amazing thing. I mean, they just never laughed at me. Dan took me on my first 12-step call, and it was at the D.C. jail. And I was really excited. And my job was to carry the book. And so I carried the book. And we went in, and he's going to talk to this guy. And this guy's facing some long and hard time. And I knew he was going to be grateful we came down there to see him. And so Dan's on the phone. And Dan was always a calm, laid-back guy, and he's talking to him. And finally he said, I'm waiting. It's like 40 minutes, right? And I got all this stuff I'm going to tell this guy. And Dan said, I got a buddy with me. He said, he's sober 2 months now. And he said, he's doing a great job. And he said, I'm going to let him talk to you for 2 or 3 minutes. I said, 2 or 3 minutes? I got a lot to say. So I grabbed that phone, and I began to preach to this guy. And finally, after about 3 minutes, he said, whoa, wait a minute. He said, look, kid. He said, this AA stuff's all right for a guy like you. He said, but I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I lost it. And I began to scream, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is leaving here in a few minutes, and one of us is going to go get locked up in a cell. And Dan didn't think it was going very well, so he was trying to get the phone from me. Well, I wasn't finished, so I was down on the ground cradling the phone, telling this guy things. And finally, the other visitors started coming out of their stall to see what was going on. And then finally, the guard came along, and Dan got the phone away from me. And he said to the guy, yeah, I'll come tomorrow. Yeah, I'll come alone. And hung up the phone. And I knew I was going to be drummed out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was over. And I'd failed the first big test. And I went outside, and I was just waiting for him to say something. You know, I just waiting. He never said anything. And finally, I said to him, Dan, that wasn't very good, was it? And he said, well, I'll be honest with you, Keith. He said, most guys wouldn't have done it that way. And he said, but, he said, we all develop our own technique in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, shortly after that, I received a letter, and I was invited to study in France. And I knew I couldn't go, because I figured out what sponsorship was about. A sponsor is someone who discovers what you really want to do and won't let you do it. And and so I wasn't given the satisfaction of telling me no, but I went to lunch with him, and I showed him the letter, and he beamed. I'll never forget. He just beamed. And he said, this is wonderful. I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. He said, this isn't about you. This is about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, the best you could do was crap your pants over on Skid Row. He said, this is about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I didn't think you'd let me go. And he said, look at me. I looked at him, and he said, listen to this. He said, and understand this. He said, you can believe, he said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. And he said, we have 3 months for you to prepare to go to France. And, you know, New Year's Eve, 1974, I'm glad I was sitting in the corner seat, because a plane settled into Orly Airport. And I was overwhelmed with the gratitude that I have to you for what you've done for me. I couldn't help but think 6.5 months before that, I couldn't leave a crummy little apartment in Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And 6.5 months later, I'm studying in France with probably the world's greatest cytologist. And I'm walking the streets of Paris, a free man. And I found a man named Charlie B., who was sober 3 years, an old-timer. And he was from Kentucky, and he was an artist. And his art studio was one block from the apartment that they gave me. And I couldn't sleep at night, and I sure couldn't sleep in the daytime. So I'd go down to Charlie's apartment at lunchtime, and I'd feed soup to French drunks, and I tell them my story. They couldn't understand English, but And I discovered that we really talk with our eyes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why being a shoe guy doesn't work well for very long. But and you know, and I was there a while, and my sponsor just happened to come through town, and we spent a week together, running all over France, taking train rides, and it was magnificent. I left there, and I went to Rome, and I stayed in a monastery for a while, just because I wanted to, and I went to. The only AA meeting they had was at 13 Via Napoli, and I went to that meeting every Tuesday, but I made a contact with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at the embassy or someplace every day I was there. And my life's been a fairy tale. It's been an absolute fairy tale. And it's because I've been sponsored every day of my sobriety. Well, for a couple years I sponsored myself, which meant I had an idiot for a sponsor, but I've really, and not only have my sponsor, I've learned that the trick isn't to give my sponsor an opportunity to agree with my plan. I sponsored a lot of people who give me an opportunity to agree with their plan. I truly go to my sponsor without a plan. And my plan gets developed in my discussion with him. And I am truly under the authority of another human being. And that's the safest place for this alcoholic to be. A lot of my friends who are sober about as long as I am don't need that anymore. And I watch some of them drift away, and I watch some of them get drunk. You know, my life is so good, it's hard to believe it's my life. And I need guidance and direction more now than I did when I was new. And I am so profoundly grateful that Tom I from Aberdeen, North Carolina, has agreed to be my sponsor. And he's been my sponsor since 1985. And I believe he's the finest member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know. And I believe that if I keep living my life based on the guidance that he provides me, that one day somebody's going to say that I'm a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my goal is to be just like him. You know, what happens to us in this program is, I think, beyond belief. Julie and I were married 13 years ago. And matter of fact, this was the first roundup that we came together. You know, prior to that time, I wouldn't think of bringing one I wasn't married to a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm a speaker in particular, because if I offend one person, then I'm not doing my job. But we were thrilled to come down here, and I met Ramona. She spoke that year, the wonderful Al-Anon, and we got to spend some time together, and then I spent some time with her out in Oklahoma, and I just learned so doggone much from her and from all the other Al-Anon and AA members that I've met over the years. Dan taught me how to get into action. Sandy, my second sponsor, taught me how to work the steps and the value and the necessity of working the steps. And living my whole life, everything I do, based on the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is it selfish? Is it self-centered? What would the master have me do? On and on and on. And that's how I try to live my life. Tom has taught me how to be a giving member of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I asked Tom to sponsor me, I was really in a pretty bad place. And I was sober about 12 years, which I know now is a very dangerous time. And at around 6 years, and at around 12 years, I just got magnificent. I couldn't help myself. And and I also got nutty as I could be. And I got into looking at me and examining me. And so I said to Tom when we met, I said, can I come over to your house? I'd like to talk to you about sponsorship. He said, I'll come to your house. And he did. He came to my house, and we talked, and I said, would you consider being my sponsor? And he said, I'd be glad to. He said, tell me. I said, what do you think I should do? You think I should start doing a fourth by doing an inventory? And he said, I have a feeling you're pretty good at that. He said, why don't you go find a new guy? And I was new in town, and I didn't have anybody. So I went to a meeting that night, and a guy walked in, you know. And I watched him for a while, and he didn't blink, so I knew I had a live one. And so I went up to him. I said, is this your first meeting? He said, yes, sir, it is. I said, well, the way we do it here is we assign you a sponsor. And so I volunteered, and I said, I'm next on the list. He said, okay. And, you know, About 6 months later, he said to me, "Other guys get to pick their sponsors." I said, "God picked yours." And so the next morning, I called Tom. I said, "Tom, I got a guy I'm sponsoring." And he said, "Heath, I'm going to enjoy sponsoring you." And I think he has, because I certainly enjoy being sponsored by him. And he's walked me through everything. He taught me how to date. He taught me how to become engaged. He taught me how to get married. He taught me that that women are really are people. I mean, they really are. And and he's taught me so very, very much. And he's taught me how to make it right with my family and all of that. And, you know, I like to tell just a little bit about my family. My my brother Terry was had what we have, and I had made amends to everybody. Except, this is just great. Let me guess. I got it figured out. The meeting is getting in the way of the dance. God, we can't let that happen. Because, you know, this is where people score tonight, you know, after the meeting. I love what my buddy Mike W. always says. Mike always says, he said, "You ever see, sick meet sick on AA campus?" He said, Needy Jane and Needy Harry get together, and he said, it's like two ticks and no dog. And but anyway, I was telling you about my brother Terry, and Terry. Terry was the one person on my amends list that I couldn't find, because whenever I came home, Terry left, because Terry was bad about drinking. And, you know, it must be hard to have a sober brother and if you're drinking. And Terry, and my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, and I know Terry would have to be there. And so, Julia had never met Terry. Sorry, the band left. and so we went home, and he was there, but I didn't really get a chance to talk to him, but I didn't get a chance to make amends. But it was shortly after that that Terry contracted cancer, and I went up to visit him. He was in the hospital, I wish you'd have known this guy, man. He was great. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy, and he was tough. He was a boxer, and he was really good. He was tough as nails, and toughest guy in the family, probably the smartest guy in the family. But he was pretty wasted from alcoholism and cancer by this time. And I went to see him in the hospital, and we had a talk that I'd been wanting to have with him forever. And he asked me, you know, I went over, and he was in bed, and he said, I said, "Could we talk?" He said, "I'd like to talk." And he said, "Would you answer a question for me?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you really believe there's a God?" I said, "Terry, I know it more certain than I know anything else." He said, "I hope you're right." He said, Could he care about a guy like me? I said, "You know, Terry, he couldn't help but love you." And we talked about some other things. And before I left, I asked him for a favor. I said, "I'd like you to do something for me." And he said, "Well, what's that?" You know, suspicious. And I said, "I would like you to let me hug you." He looked at me, and he got out of bed, and he was real frail. He weighed less than 100 pounds. And this guy was like a brick wall. I weighed less than 100 pounds, and I got to hug my brother Terry and to tell him how very sorry I was for my arrogance and my judgmentalness. One of my gifts after I got sober was I was given an opportunity to go back to school. They gave me a scholarship at Georgetown, and I took a degree in philosophy and theology. One of the things I learned in my theology was that there are two kinds of time. You know, there's chronological time, which is linear, and then there's that's called chronos, and then there's something called kairos, which is God's time, and it's now, it's always now. And, you know, I only hugged my brother Terry for a few seconds in chronological time, but I hugged him forever in God's time. And when I was driving back, it occurred to me that I always think in linear terms, and I always think of the time I wasted, or the this I wasted, or all the rest of it. And I discovered that day that my job isn't to think about it in linear terms. It's to think about it in God's terms. That's why the old timers always told us, God lives now. He He doesn't live in the past and he doesn't live in the future. He lives now, because the only time I can experience God is now. And my brother Terry passed away, and he died the way I want to die, you know. The last thing he said to me when I left that hospital room was, he said, "You know, Keith, I don't think I have to drink anymore." And I said, "You know, I don't think you do either." And, you know, 6 months later, my brother Terry passed away clean and sober and surrounded by the people who love him, having made amends to a lot of people in those 6 months. And one day, I want to be surrounded by people. I want to be clean, and I want to be sober, and I want to be surrounded by people I love. And I want, to the best of my ability, for there not to be anything that I haven't made amends for. You know, that's, I had a father who never told me he loved me, and that's why I was the way I was. And that same father who I'd grown to know and to love in sobriety, and to whom I made my amends, this past December, Julia and I were up to see him, and he was on his deathbed. And I'd been up a couple months earlier, a couple times, to visit with him. And he was still very, very lucid. And I said to him, "Dad, is there anything that we haven't said to each other?" And he said, "No, son." He said, "I know you love me, and you know I love you." He said, "There is one thing I'd like to say." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "I want to thank you for everything you've done for so many people, especially the people in our family." And this was a man who wouldn't tell me when the family reunion was 30 years before. And when he passed away this past December, I was holding his hand, and Julia and a number of my brothers and sisters were there. And I had whispered in his ear that it was all right to go, that I would pray for the people he prayed for every day, and that I would take it from here. Not as well, but I would take it. And you know, we prayed, his favorite prayer was a Hail Mary, and we prayed a Hail Mary, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer. And when we said amen, he squeezed my hand, and he went to join his wife in eternity. And I left the room, and I said to Julia, "I'm not supposed to live like this. Alcoholics aren't supposed to live like this. I'm supposed to be down the street trying to drink up enough courage to come here. And I owe it all to you. Everything that's in my life, everything that I experience, everything I know, everything I am, I owe to you, my dear, dear friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you."